Gerald Posner is back on the show with me today. I've talked to him many times through the years about some of the great books he's written, full of amazing investigative reporting. And his new book is called God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican, in which he has spent nearly a decade looking into the finances of the Vatican and uncovered some things that I think we could describe as unsavory. Gerald, good to have you back on the show.
Good to be back with you, Paul.
You know, I didn't know that there was such a thing as the Vatican Bank. I didn't know that the church was as rich as it is. You describe it in the book as being akin to a Wall Street investment bank, right?
Right. I mean, but mid-size at best by Wall Street standards. I mean, it pales in significance to, let's say, to HSBC or Citibank or Barclays. So the Wall Street banks have more money in terms of billions of dollars, but the Vatican... And we're talking, when I say the Vatican, I mean just that little parcel of land that's in the heart of Rome that is also a sovereign country. I'm not talking about all the thousands of dioceses around the world. I'm not talking about New York and Chicago and in London where they've got tens of millions of dollars in property and they raise their own money. I'm talking about sort of the bank that operates inside Vatican City that is like a cross between a Federal Reserve and something like an investment bank in Wall Street. It operates, you know, as aggressively and has gotten itself into scandal after scandal since its creation in World War II. So it's an unusual hybrid.
What got you interested in writing about this?
Actually, it was, you talked before about, you know, I've had the pleasure of being on with you before, you're right. It was my very, very first book that sort of put the subject in the back of my mind. I was doing the biography on Joseph Mengele, the doctor from the Auschwitz concentration camp called the Angel of Death. I was down in Argentina, and I got access to the federal police files there on Mengele. And while there, I saw other files that showed some Nazis had arrived in Argentina with the assistance of a priest in Rome after the war, this Father Weber, and a bishop, this Bishop Udall. And I sort of put in the back of my mind to go back one day and look at the possibility of whether the Vatican had more than just helping Nazis out after the war, whether they actually did business with Germany. And when I finally found a publisher, more than 25 years later, that said, go and look at it, it turned out to be an ever-growing story. So what I thought was a World War II story turns out to be a 200-year history of fall of the money in the Vatican.
And you found a financial connection between the Vatican and the Nazis?
I did. As a matter of fact, I think this is the first book that actually explains how they, meaning the Vatican, did it. Right in the heart of World War II, 1942, the war starts in 39 and ends in 45, so literally in the middle, the financial savant, a layman who had been hired by the Vatican to invest its money, had decided that he needed a bank. And the reason he needed this bank, and it's not just a regular bank, it doesn't have to turn a profit, it doesn't give loans, it answers to one shareholder, only the Pope, but because the Vatican's also a country, it operates like the central bank. He wanted to be able to do business off the radar, in the dark, because the Americans and British intelligence were trying to stop neutral countries, so-called neutral countries like the Vatican, from doing business with the Germans and the Italians. And the Vatican wanted to keep doing it. So when they did it through these Italian proxies that owned interest in Italian and German insurance companies, mostly in the killing fields of Eastern Europe, and they earned outsized profits. What I realized after I got through much of this research is that surprised me at first, but it shouldn't have surprised me because actually the Vatican was investing on both sides. It had brought gold to America. It bought American big stocks of big American companies. It bought property in London. And it also was investing in the Germans and Italians because it didn't know who would win the war. So they were hedging their bets, and that makes sense. It's just that I've laid it out here how they were hedging their bets with the Germans.
Well, it makes sense if you don't consider the morality of the investment.
Excuse me for laughing, but you're absolutely right. No, it's not to say that it's outrageous. I mean that it makes sense right from that very practical, cold, callous viewpoint. But the interesting thing about this, and the reason I laugh is because it comes back to a very, very significant historical question that's been debated among World War II historians for a long time, and that is, could the Pope during World War II, Pius XII, have been more proactive in condemning the civilian slaughter, the Holocaust, that the Vatican was learning about very early on from all the priests who were in Poland and other areas where the killing fields were? Could he have been much more adamant about it? And he was scared of speaking out because he thought that Hitler would move against the Catholics in Germany, he might even move against the Pope, and they were petrified in the Vatican City about Stalin and the Reds. But I also introduced the financial component. Third Reich was collecting a tax on every German Catholic they were sending to the Vatican. It was about $100 million worth in the middle of the war. That was a lot of money. The Vatican knew they would lose that if they spoke out too harshly on the Germans. And in addition, they had these investments, which we now know about. So to the extent that there were a lot of reasons why the Pope wasn't more vocal, finances and money was one of them.
So you're saying that the Pope then, and I'm guessing popes since, have known about this?
Well, yeah, popes since have come in. As a matter of fact, the Pope at that time then used the Vatican Bank after the war with American and British intelligence to help send some Nazis to South America. We wanted Nazis who were in the intelligence business saved because we're in the new Cold War. Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, was picked up by American intelligence. We actually dropped him off at a train station in Genoa where he was handed over to a priest who ran a monastery out of Rome who put him into the Vatican rat line and sent him down to South America. And in 1948, in the first post-war election in Italy, the Vatican used the Vatican Bank with the assistance of the Pope to send in millions of dollars of U.S. money to help the conservatives defeat the communists. And the same thing happened under the Polish Pope. In the late 70s and early 80s, the Vatican Bank was used as a conduit by U.S., by the CIA and by British intelligence to send money to Solidarity and all those institutions in Eastern Europe that were fighting the Iron Curtain and communism. But in time, it also became a repository for money launderers, the wealthy in Italy to avoid taxes, the mob, and a political slush fund for some of Italy's biggest politicians. So that was the bad side of it.
I wanted to ask you about the mob because this is a fascinating part of your book where the mafia money is hidden inside Vatican finances. But you say that you think it was without the knowledge of church hierarchy, right?
Yeah, they didn't want to know who was depositing these big cash deposits, if that makes sense. They gave them some plausible deniability. So once it went past the Monsignor who opened up the account at the Vatican Bank for somebody and that person stayed secret, nobody would then say to a higher-ranking cardinal or the Pope, by the way, that fellow's a fellow from the Colombo family. But what happened is the reason it became such a spot is it's literally, those who have been, your listeners who have been to Vatican City know, that it's only 0.2 mile wide. It's tiny. You cross it in 15 or 20 minutes. And it is in the center of Rome with no wall around it. So it literally would be as if New York City, if Times Square was its own country, but without a wall around it, and if you lived 2 blocks outside of Times Square, all you had to do was find somebody who lived in Times Square who was willing to take your million or 5 million or 10 million in cash. You could do a physical deposit. The Vatican Bank accepts those. Bring it in on a truckload or pallets of cash. And once it went inside that, quote, sovereign country of Vatican City, it disappeared. Nobody could follow it. No Italian tax investigators, no drug investigators, nobody from the DEA. So the mafia loved this. Tax evaders loved it. And the Vatican earned a small commission off of the funds, so they loved it. And for a long time, it flourished until just recently, the last 4 or 5 years, they've started to clean up their act.
You know, it sounds a little bit like when we used to be able to, not we, I never did, but when somebody who had all the money could put it into a Swiss bank account, and like you say, it would essentially disappear from the radar of the world. And I find it ironic, we're talking about Swiss bank accounts and the Vatican, which is guarded by the Swiss Guard.
Yeah, that's right. It's wonderful. There's the connection, the 6 degrees of separation.
Right.
And Paul, what it made the Vatican Bank even, and I think you'll get this immediately when I say it, even in some ways more attractive as an offshore bank in the heart of Rome, is that for the Swiss banks or those in the Cayman Islands or those in the Bahamas or Hong Kong, Singapore, somebody who is in the U.S. or wherever else they want to take the money and hide it, they have to wire it in. It leaves an electronic transaction that it can eventually be traced back. With the Vatican Bank, it's the only bank that's literally sitting in the middle of a foreign capital. It's in the capital of another country. So it would be as if it was in London or Paris or wherever else. So instead of a wire service, you literally can make the physical deposit and leave no transaction history at all about the money, and that was the great advantage they had over all the other offshore banks.
I'm just making a note to myself here, get a pallet full of money. That sounds like something I want, Gerald.
Pallets of cash. I've only heard about them. I would love to see one once. It'd be a great Facebook picture, I'm sure.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris talking with Gerald Posner about his new book, God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. There's one part of the story that I was fascinated by in reading, and I wonder if you'd share it with my audience. It's the story of an American archbishop named Paul Marcinkus, who ran the Vatican Bank for almost two decades, right?
Right, yeah.
And was also a spy.
Yeah, Marcinkus is an amazing character. You see that straight out of Central Casting. He's like 6'3", almost 6'4". He comes from Cicero, Illinois, same hometown as Al Capone, but no relation and nothing to do with that. It's just the marker. And he moves up fast in the Vatican hierarchy. He's a brash American that all the Italian clerics dislike because he's so American. But Pope Paul VI, the Pope in the 60s, makes him head of the Vatican Bank. And why? Because he trusts him, not because Marcinkus knows anything about finances. He buys a few books to try to learn about it, and that's the problem. He's quickly involved in business and in partnership with some Italian businessmen who are real sharks. And the Vatican Bank eventually ends up doing hundreds of millions of dollars of fraudulent loans. They pay out at the end of his 20-year tenure $250 million as moral considerations to victims. And the two main businessmen that Marcinkus works with, one of them ends up hanging under a London bridge. It's deemed a suicide, and 25 years later, they finally can prove it's a murder. He's a banker. And the other, a prominent businessman, is sentenced to jail for having killed the prosecutor chasing the whole case, and he dies of cyanide, and that's ruled a suicide. The Italians indict Marcinkus and his two top aides in the Vatican Bank, and this is when the Vatican then pulls out, we're a sovereign country, and they say you can't bring anybody out of our country. Marcinkus and his two aides hide inside Vatican City. The Italians can't get them, and the Italian Supreme Court eventually rules the Vatican sovereignty is unbreakable. You can't get these guys. Marcinkus returned to the U.S. and died a couple of years ago, literally running out his time in a little retirement parish in Sun City, Arizona.
But the other part of the story is he was simultaneously a spy for the United States State Department.
Thanks so much for reminding me of the key factor that I uncovered in this book. It's good that somebody is thinking here. I uncovered in doing this work that he was the highest-ranking confidential informant the State Department ever had inside the Vatican. Not surprisingly, the small embassy mission that we had for the U.S. State Department used him constantly, and he tried to get the Pope's speeches to be more pro-American on everything from missile defense to rallying defense budgets in South America against communism. So he turns out to be a critical source of information. He's providing it back to the U.S. government, and at the same time, he's running the shady Vatican Bank. He's a great character.
10 years ago, Gerald, when you and I talked about your book, Secrets of the Kingdom, which was about the Saudis using petrodollars to influence U.S. power elite, you went into great detail about how much influence they had because of those pallets full of money and barrels full of oil that they had. Is the same thing true about the Vatican with all of its wealth?
Well, I think that the Vatican's power also comes from that strange mixture that it has, or unusual mixture, that it is the only religion that is also a sovereign country. So it's that, the Saudis are the home of Islam, yes, and that's where Mecca is and everything else, but the Saudis don't speak as a single voice for all of Islam, as we see. Shiites and Sunnis are killing each other all the time. The Pope may have some Catholics who don't follow him on issues relating to abortion or birth control, but they still answer to the Pope, and if he sets the rules, they'll follow what he does in the Mass and the liturgy. So that Pope is responsible for 1.3 billion people, the second largest religion in the world, just behind Islam. That head of the church runs all the religious aspects, and at the same time is also a sovereign that, you know, has a status at the United Nations and can sit in on peace talks if they want to. That's what gives them that dual-edged power. The money is key to them, but not as critical as it might be to the Saudis, who buy their influence everywhere. The church gets it based upon the fact that its believers believe that it is the successor to the only true church on earth for 2,000 years.
Gotcha. Were the Vatican's finances hurt by the pedophilia scandal?
No, you know, that's so great, Paul. I have only one chapter on the pedophilia scandal, and it's only about looking at it in terms of money. How did the Vatican approach it? The Vatican didn't get, well, and I say they didn't get hit at all. They protected themselves immediately. When they saw these start to come out in the U.S., they made sure that the legal apparatus was in place so that if one diocese got sued by victims and that diocese had financial problems in paying the settlement, that it would not bring down the diocese next to it. And that's exactly what's happened. 11 dioceses, for instance, in America have gone bankrupt, and they haven't affected very wealthy dioceses next to them. At the same time, the Vatican was petrified that the Pope would be sued by some clever American class action lawyer saying, hey, Pontiff, you're the employer of these priests, these pedophile priests. you should ultimately be responsible. We're going to come after Vatican Bank money. So those suits were eventually filed. There were different lower court opinions, but finally an appellate court held here in the U.S. He's a sovereign of another country. That's what saved him. You can't sue him in an American court over these issues. So the Vatican didn't pay a financial price, except that American Catholics and Catholics in other countries who they've had to contribute more money to the parishes where there have been big settlements have sent less money on to Rome as gifts to the Pope. So the donations dropped, but we don't know to what extent.
So there were settlements, hush money, if you will, in some cases. In other cases, kind of recompense for victims. But because of that and the bad publicity from that, the number of coins being dropped in the plate every week were down?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, I have a figure in there that as of 2013, I think it is, $2 billion is what was spent on settlements so far, and I'm talking internationally, and about $1 billion estimated on legal costs and appeals and all. So it's $3 billion have been spent. It's an astonishing figure.
And the fact that did not cripple any organization, religious or otherwise, a $3 billion payout gives you an idea of the scale of the organization.
Yeah, that's right. And remember that what they have is they don't have oil, as the Saudis have, but they have a different thing. They have people of faith who are willing to help the church out and send money back to the Pope. Next year, for instance, Pope Francis has declared it a holy year, a jubilee year. Those usually come around every 25 years. That means that if you go to Rome as a practicing Catholic, you can get special blessings. The Pope will have special meetings. It's also a great fundraiser. They raise millions of dollars in a jubilee year. So they know how to do it very well.
And he's coming to America later this year, isn't he?
He is, in fact. As a matter of fact, he's coming to Philadelphia and Washington and New York. I'm trying to get signatures on an online petition that I have to ask him to release the Vatican bank files from World War II, because I can bring you so far in this book as to what they were doing with the Germans, but only they know the extent of it. And I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell that's going to happen, because they would be afraid over there of restitution if it was shown that they were making big profits knowingly making it. In the 90s, when there were big restitution efforts for Holocaust victims with insurance companies and Swiss banks and others, the Vatican sat in on those hearings. The Clinton administration sort of, you know, convinced them they had to, but they refused to, you know, give a penny toward it. So I think the fear of restitution will keep those files secret.
Is the church cleaning up under Francis?
It is. When he first came in and said, you know, I'm going to reform the Vatican Bank, I was skeptical because other popes have said that and they have failed to do it. But he has proven to, so far, be the real deal on it. He's put in a series of reforms and hired some independent outside financial people that if he is pope long enough, another 3 to 5 years probably, he will change the underlying bureaucracy of the bank. That's what really has to change, that culture. And if he can do that, Paul, going forward, it will be a mundane, ordinary, run-of-the-mill sort of, you know, investment bank of sorts, and it will have occasional scandals, as every bank does. We see things with, you know, you'll hear about secret bank accounts in HSBC, or you'll hear about some trader who went crazy at Barclays and lost $2 billion on bonds. So I'm sure there will be scandals, but it won't be an ingrained, what I call sort of outlier offshore bank, as it has been for most of its history.
Well, that would be an amazing change after the 200 years that you have detailed in the book. It's called God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican, a 9-year research project now in print by this gentleman right here, Gerald Posner. Thanks so much for joining me again. It's always a pleasure.
Paul, thank you so much. Always great to talk to you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.